All right, let's get started, shall we? If you haven't signed in, please do. If you're not registered, please see me. I will give you a registration form, and I will then put it in the office. But everybody who's sitting here needs to be registered. It's the way that Adult Ed gets paid for this free class that we have. Okay? So please, sign in every week. If you're not registered, see me. I'll give you a registration form. The something else is, if you're not registered and have been in this class previously and have signed in, I have a list here of such people. Come up and see me, and I will give you a registration form. But we can't, just signing in there doesn't get us paid for your presence. You have to actually be registered. So thank you for coming out on this tremendously rainy and challenging morning. I hope you have a good time. Oh, I know the other thing. I hope it's worth it. The other thing that I wanted to say is I see each week who is here because I have to report the attendance each week. So I know you're here, but I haven't said hello to everybody, so hello. Come up afterward and say hi if I haven't seen you in a while. If I don't know who you are, because there are some people in the class whose names are familiar to me but faces aren't, come up and introduce yourself so I know in whose company I am. So this morning what we'll do is, first we'll do some mindfulness, then we'll finish the video that we were watching on mindfulness. We're almost done with it, but I did want to show you the last couple of speakers. And I'll comment a little on what they have to say. That was something we did several weeks ago. And then we'll look at the third of the three possible positions about consciousness and the universe. You may recall the first position that we looked at is the position that consciousness and the physical universe are co-fundamental. That is, they're both kinds of reality that intersect in human beings, and presumably in other animals, but certainly in human beings. So there's a fundamental equivalence of the mental world and the physical world. And that's called panpsychism, and sometimes Rupert Sheldrake is in that camp. That was the first possibility, which is consciousness and physical reality coexist as basic parts of reality. Second position we looked at was what Murray Gell-Mann talked about, which is physical reality gives birth, consciousness emerges from physical reality. So physical reality is the most real, and then consciousness is not, it's real, but in a different sense. It's more fundamental than consciousness is physical reality, which issues forth consciousness. And the third position is the opposite position. The position that consciousness is primary, and that physical reality comes forth from it. And that's the one we're going to look at in some detail today. And I know you're familiar with all three of these positions, but it's interesting to hear brilliant thinkers espouse on these three positions. All right, so mindfulness. You can do anything you like in the 10 minutes that we're sitting. You don't have to do mindfulness. If you do mindfulness, you might remember metta, M-E-T-T-A. It's usually nice. Many of us, at the end of our mindfulness sitting, when our mind is very quiet and focused, we do a little metta. That is, we do a little loving of ourselves and other people and the world. Or some people pray, you know, during the meditation. So I would encourage you to not stay entirely kind of on the mental level, but involve the heart as much as possible. Another thing I wanted to, so if you're going to do mindfulness, one thing I wanted to talk about right now is mindfulness as surrender. Surrender is kind of a tricky word, but it doesn't mean you lose in this context. It means you open up without reservation to what is. You don't try to change it or object to it or get away from it. You just simply surrender to it. So the process of becoming mindful is a process of just letting go absolutely on all levels, and whatever is, is. After you sit, then you don't have to maintain quite that level of openness and objectivity and non-reactivity. But when you're sitting, you really capitulate to reality, whatever mental and physical reality is. So you don't object to things. And it doesn't mean that you identify with everything. It means that you acknowledge that everything is as it is at this moment. So I think that's enough intro. Why don't we sit for 10 minutes, okay?
Physical universe and consciousness equally primary, and consciousness primary, physical world arises from it. So we've looked at the first two a little bit, now today we're going to look at the third, after we finish the video on mindfulness. If you missed any class and want to hear it again, or if you want to hear it again, even if you haven't missed it, you go to swt.org/Spencer. Robert puts all the classes on our website. If you missed Carl Blasius' class last week, you go to swt.org/Spencer, and then you look for the section with Carl's various lectures.
There's also copies of the handouts, like the one you had with Essence.
Also, Essence is on
well,
there.
I mean, I try to get all of your handouts.
Okay, so everything I hand out is also there. Okay, so let's see. Michael.
And just real quick, as an aside, by the way, the author of that article is very happy to hear that.
Oh, you talked to Karen Maffin.
Yeah. Okay. She was very happy.
Well, that article I've probably shared that with several thousand people at this point. I mean, it's just such a perfect article.
It's not a one reading.
Okay, so that Michael has actually studied with Karen Malik. And so when he told me that he had studied with her, and I said, that's amazing, because I knew nothing about her. And he actually just said that he told her that we read the article, and she was happy about it. Okay, Abraham.
Yeah, I would like to know the difference between surrendering and accepting.
There is a difference between surrendering and accepting, maybe. Depends on how you believe, how you define accepting. But surrendering is just simply acknowledging the existence of something. I give up. It is. It is. I don't like the fact that I'm this, that, or the other thing, or that they're this, that, or the other thing, the world is this, that, or the other thing, but it is. Accepting seems to be a more active process of saying it's okay. Sometimes it's not okay, but it still is. That's a way to put it, okay? Though it's, the way other people use acceptance, it would be equivalent. All right, so let's watch the last little part of this video. I don't think we need to pull the shades. Let's see how it is when I turn the lights off.
I remember you saying, "I won't forget the light checks."
Everybody talks like that.
You appear.
Can we just run through
it? I would love it.
This what really hurts.
So,
how do
you
I don't want any of the ads. All right, so I'm going to start us, this is reasonable, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Not so much what you see is what you hear anyway. So I'm going to start us with that, I'm not sure he's Buddhist, but I think so, because that was the last part that we saw, and he's such a sweet person that I thought we'd do him again and then go from there. So this is good. This is Daniel Goleman. He's going to end in a few seconds.
In the face of stress, and this lets us be calmer in the face of stress. And this is another benefit that we see right from the beginning. We all need that peace of mind. So the peace of mind comes from the mindfulness. Through that, we understand how important kindness and compassion. One mental good quality leads into the next, and the next, and the next. Life's not perfect. Life never be perfect. How much we put into effort. To be perfect is not perfect everything. We are human. Patience is a wonderful to have. So, if that day and somebody who in your life, if he or she is so stressful, and at that time, sometimes not necessarily, there's not much room for communicating. Just be patient. Just be as a human being. We all need that kind of quality. But yet again, the seeds, we all have that. We all have a patient. How much we call an impatient person, he or she has some seeds of the patience and the kindness and the compassion. All of these seeds, we didn't have to buy anywhere. We have. We all have a room to grow, and but we all have a seeds. What a
So I'm going to stop it each time because I have stuff to say about it. Right.
So patience, I want to talk just a tiny bit about patience. First of all, those of you who do any kind of mental or physical health care work, I think there's a correlation between how much patience you have and how many patients you have. Because it turns out that, at least for the mental work, it generally doesn't happen as swiftly as you would wish. And it's important, I think, to be patient and respect the rhythm of growth of the person that you're working with. In general, and one more thing about helping people is I think we have a tendency to want to fix people that are in distress. And unfortunately, when we're trying to fix, the energy is coming from us toward the person, and that doesn't seem to be received at all or very well frequently. What needs to happen is the energy needs to come from the person. And that involves letting go of the impulse to change what is in front of you and simply opening up the space for growth to happen. Also, if you want to fix the person that's in front of you, this is not just a patient, this is anybody you relate to that's sharing difficulty with you, the impulse is to try to tell them what to do, to fix them, right? And when you do that, you're implicitly saying to them that there's something wrong with them, that you agree. And so it makes them feel worse, because now you're both convinced that there's something that needs to change, that there's something wrong. The wrong typically comes from conditional love. And if you give that person conditional love, you're reinforcing that process. If instead you accept the person as they are, that acceptance then heals them. Because flawed though they are, they're expressing some distress about themselves, typically, or the world, they're distressed. And instead of saying, you shouldn't be distressed, you're simply saying, oh, okay, distressed, it's okay. And that makes them feel better. And eventually, that unconditional love you give them fills in the hole that the conditional love made. If you look at almost everything that's wrong with people psychologically, it all has to do with feeling that at some level they're not acceptable. Because they weren't accepted for certain things. And if you can accept them, that then fills in that chasm of non-acceptability, of feeling that there's something wrong. The other thing about patience, or another thing about patience, is we're always trying to solve stuff. Life presents a lot of problems, one after the other, and we always try to kind of fix them. And it takes a lot of effort, and is often exhausting and futile. If, on the other hand, you simply sit with what is, surprisingly often, the problems solve themselves. There's a movement to them which ultimately makes things better. And over and over and over again, I see this with my clients, which is there's always an impulse. Some of what I do is coaching, and some of the people I coach are business people, and there's always an impulse when something goes wrong to change, to do something, because they're doers, you know, fix that. And my counsel frequently is, why are you getting involved with that? Just give it a little time, and it solves itself. And I think in life a lot is like that. But it's necessary to have that faith that it'll solve itself, and I don't need to exhaust myself and maybe make things worse by trying to make things better. So let's see. We'll go to two, Gordon and then Tim. Okay, Gordon, loud if you can, and I'll repeat it.
Yeah, how do you deal with an alcoholic in your life that keeps putting you down, criticizing?
He's asking, how do you deal with an alcoholic in your life that's always criticizing you and putting you down?
Besides going to Al-Anon.
I think the first thing you do is when the person criticizes you and puts you down, you say, you know, I don't appreciate that you're criticizing me and putting me down. It doesn't help either of us.
But she keeps doing it anyway.
Okay, then you say that's unacceptable. If you start to do that, then I will leave right now.
I can't leave. We both live in the same space.
When she's in a receptive mood, you say, look, let's make a timeout thing here. So that when you start doing that, I can go like this, and it temporarily pauses things. I don't know if you can do that. I've not been so successful in counseling people to do that. In the heat of whatever, one or the other doesn't respect that timeout. But if you can forge that agreement when things are going decently well, then when things start to get upsetting, then you can say, this is not timeout. Let's just break for a while. But in terms of the problem, you don't accept the problem. There is a problem, okay? You say, I accept you, but your behavior, I don't accept. That's what unconditional positive regard, Carl Rogers is always misunderstood. You mean I should accept my kid doing this or my spouse doing that? No, that's unacceptable. Yeah, it is. What you do is you give them, you never withdraw your love. You love them because they're human and because you're related, connected to them. So you give them love, but you very clearly say what is good behavior, acceptable behavior, and not acceptable behavior. If you do that, it's going to have this good consequence. If you do this, it's going to have that bad consequence. It's your choice, but if you choose the bad consequence, I'm not going to be part of it, and I'm going to object to it. So you affirm the person, and you correct the behavior. You don't tell your kid, I don't love you now, you're a bad boy or a bad girl. You say, I love you no matter what, and you made a really lousy choice. Why don't you make a better choice? That way you raise what's called instrumentally competent kids. Kids that know that what happens to them is a result of the choices they make. Life doesn't happen to them. They create the life that they're having by the choices that they make. A lot of people don't realize that. There's something called, I didn't know I was going all these places, but why not? There's something called locus of control that I've spoken to you about before. There are two possibilities, an internal locus of control and an external locus of control. Julian Rotter, Rotter, was the guy that first talked about this. External locus of control is what's usual. You get up in the morning, and you think, what do I have to do today? And you deal with all the stuff that you have to deal with, and you go to bed at night, and if it was an okay day, you think, thank God, I didn't screw it up. You're reacting to life. Life is the control is outside. Outside is controlling you, you're doing your best to navigate. People with an internal locus of control are much rarer. They're people who get up in the morning and say, what am I creating for my life today? And as the things happen in their lives, they either choose them, or when calamities happen or difficulties happen, they say, instead of it's a problem and I gotta deal with it, it's a challenge that will cause me to grow. It's something that will make me better. And so they feel that their life is a consequence of their choices rather than their life is a consequence.
I'm sorry, what's his name?
Rotter, Julian Rotter, Rotter. Okay. All right. So anyway, back to patience. Winning down about what to do. Oprah said this. I'm sorry, Tim. Let me say this now, and I'll call on you. So, Oprah said this. She said when she was talking about this is the commencement speech to the Stanford class of 2008. An incredibly good speech that Oprah Winfrey gave to that class, and you can find it on YouTube, of course. And she gave that speech because Gail King's daughter was graduating, and so she got invited to give the speech there. So when she talked about what happened with her school in South Africa, when there was that accusation of sexual misconduct against one of the faculty members. No, that She did talk about that, but that's not illustrating this point. What's illustrating this point is she said, when you don't know what to do, then don't do anything. You sit down and you be still, be very still, is what she said. And you wait, and when it becomes clear what to do, then you do it. But the first thing you do when something happens is you don't automatically react. You consciously choose when and how to react. That is a huge lesson that we'll learn for the rest of our lives, which is something happens and then there's an automatic reaction. That's the way things happen. When one's mindful, there's the possibility of a pause between the stimulus and the response. That's what Viktor Frankl said. He said, between the stimulus and the response, there is the freedom to choose. There is a moment when you go, when you want to react automatically, but you don't. You just let go, and you feel that reaction, but you don't act on it. And then you choose consciously what's the best way to interact with the situation. I don't know if I'll never learn that lesson completely, but at least when you are reacting unconsciously, when somebody says something and you say something right back, at the same time that you're reacting unconsciously, you're conscious enough to realize you're not doing the best thing. So I think that's step one is you still react, but you react with some modicum of awareness, so maybe it attenuates your reaction, and at least you realize you're screwing up. And then after a while, you can feel that impulse without automatically reacting in an unhelpful way. Tim.
Yeah, I find that the problem brings up learning for me. And if someone comes along and fixes the problem, then I lose the chance, the opportunity to solve it, learn.
Yeah, so that's a really good point, which is it doesn't do the person that you're talking to any good if you know the answer, okay? And in fact, it robs them of the opportunity to find out for themselves. And I know people sometimes say, don't tell me, I don't want to hear it. I want to discover it, I want to figure it out. So I think that's, if you really care about somebody, you want them to grow from what they're experiencing. You want them to overcome it. You don't want to be the one that save them, you want them to save themselves, right? Become a stronger person. I totally agree with you. Leon.
So, I never heard that expression about instrumental, and I missed the word before and after about children. It's not really instrumental.
You want kids to be instrumentally competent. That's a word that comes from, I'm saying these references because some of you have studied this stuff. A woman named Diana Baumrind, B-A-U-M-R-I-N-D, Diana Baumrind, is the classic researcher. She worked in the 1960s on parenting styles. And she identified four parenting styles. I gotta tell you the four parenting styles. She identified four parenting styles, and she said only one of them leads to instrumentally competent kids. Instrumentally competent kids are kids that can work the world in a way that works. They're instrumentally competent. They know how to work themselves in the world. So Baumrind's, in a nutshell, Baumrind's four styles. She talked about two dimensions, warmth and control. The one that has no warmth and no control are the dismissive parents or the neglectful parents. The neglectful parents. They are not interacting with their kids. They maybe have caregivers for the kids or they just ignore their kids. So the kids neither get love nor do they get guidance. And those kids go up to be not very okay. Then there are people that are parents that are controlling, but they're not warm. They're authoritarian parents. They say, do it because I'm the parent, you're the child, shut up and do what I tell you. The kids learn to be obedient to people with more power, but when they get into positions where they are bigger or more powerful than other people, they do the same thing to those other people, so they become bullies. Because they were bullied, then they bully others. At the same time, they're very insecure, because they're always being told, do this, do that, you're wrong, you're bad. So children of authoritarian parents don't do well either. And then there are the, what I used to call hippie parents, but a lot of us are hippies, so I don't use that term anymore. They're permissive parents. They're high on love, but low on control. Mom, I'm going to run off and join the circus. Oh, that's wonderful, dear. We love you. Send us a postcard. So those kind of kids, kids who were raised with a lot of love but no boundaries, no rules, no discipline, those kids grow up to be terrorists because they don't have any boundaries. They take your clothes. They take your car. They take your time. They take your everything because they don't have any sense that it's too much, that people have got to be respected. So those kids aren't terribly instrumentally competent either. And then there's the fourth kind, which is parents that are both warm, always showing love and concern, and have rules and guidance. And when things don't go right, they say, no, you violated the rule that we agreed on. You know, there's going to be this consequence. So there is guidance and there is warmth, and those kids grow up to be instrumentally competent.
Thank you.
All right, let's go back to this.
We got to go here, then go back here. Okay.
It's a good thing that we have the subtitles and that they're big, because the sound system, I don't know if you can hear it, but it sounds like a lot of garble to me. So. We do the best we can with it.
Let me see if I can... play that and that. Let's
see if I can fool with it. All right, here goes.
Seeds. One of the most important things, whether you're looking at the Christian literature or the Buddhist literature or Jewish literature or Hindu literature, it doesn't matter. All of the meditative traditions within those classical schools of thought are saying the most important thing is that you become less focused on yourself, caring only about yourself, less selfish, as it were, and more open to the needs of others, more compassionate, more caring, more present to other people. If you look at longer-term meditators, people who've done more than, say, 1,000 or 2,000 hours of meditation over their entire life, and this happens naturally. You know, let's say you do a half hour of sit every morning before you go out for the day. Well, after a decade or two, it does add up. And it seems that that cumulative amount does make people less selfish, less just caring about me, and more open to other people around, more caring, more able to tune in, more able to empathize. This also shows up in a brain change, which we think is quite significant, which is that the nucleus accumbens, which is the focus of craving, of you know, I gotta have that, drug addiction, for example, becomes smaller in longer term meditators, and this seems to be related to this lack of I, me, mine in how people behave and how they think in their emotional life. And we see it most strikingly, of course, in Olympic level meditators, where these are people who have done 10,000 or more, 10,000 to 62,000 hours of meditation. And they are genuinely selfless people, but they're very nourishing, very enjoyable to be with, because they pay attention to you. They really focus on the person they're with and how they can be of service. So what do you need now? And it's very refreshing.
Ha! Of many things that I could say about what he just said, I'll just briefly say three things, I think. Thing one, openness. Well, that's what we're practicing. For however much we're sitting, we're practicing being open. And so that openness then transfers into life. And when I teach my... positive psychology class,
We do a whole hour on paying attention, paying full attention. That is not being lost in one's own thoughts, but simply being completely open, listening with our whole body, being completely open to the other person without any kind of judgment of them or response being framed in our mind. And if that starts to happen, we just let go of it. So we're basically mindful as we're listening. We're just completely sharing the experience. And I think that those of us who have been sitting for a while, we do that just kind of naturally better when we interact with other people. And that's noticed by other people. And it's not, it's a rarity. It's not something that they usually experience. And people who are good at this kind of listening, people come to them because it's so nice to be heard fully, to be fully seen and heard. So I think that's a great social benefit of the eyes closed sitting that we do. It actually makes us more open. What? So how do you? What are you? Mike, we're not there yet. Would you? Okay. So first, that was the first thing. The nucleus accumbens. In the middle of the brain, what I've talked about this a bunch of times, in the middle of the brain, there's something called the reward pathway in the limbic system. Here's the cerebral cortex, where the thinking that we're doing now takes place, in the prefrontal cortex. Underneath it, deeper in the brain, is the reward pathway, from the ventral tegmental area to the nucleus accumbens. Little bitty areas, runs by dopamine, the neurotransmitter dopamine. And it gets us to go get something that we desire. And if it turns out that that's good, if it satisfies what we got, then it gets us to get more of it. And that in evolution, that's really important. You want animals to get that which is life enhancing. You want them to be motivated to go get that. By the way, the other system is the fight-or-flight mechanism. That tells us to go away from that which is life-denying or life-taking. So these two basic motives are the basic motives of all life, plant and animal. There's just different mechanisms in different organisms. But in the animal kingdom, these mechanisms are fairly, they've been there for a lot of evolution. The go-get-it system and the go-away-from-it system. So there's nothing wrong with the reward pathway, but the reward pathway can become too dominant. A French guy who writes about this stuff. It'll come back. Anyway. Abraham,
Yeah, since he says that opening up to other people and care for other people more than yourself, what happened to self-love?
What happened to self?
Yeah, self-love. Is it selfish?
Okay, so I'm coming to that. That's the third thing I want to say. Okay. Matthew Ricard. So Matthew Ricard says, desire, there's no problem with desire, it's obsessive desire that's the problem. That is, when we desire something that's not good for us. In nature, what you desire is good for you. You go toward that which is life-affirming, but nature doesn't have meth, and heroin, and crack cocaine, and porn, and shopping, and all this kind of stuff that overstimulates this reward pathway. So it's healthy to have desire, but it's unhealthy to have desire for things which are not life-affirming, and to have one's life run by desire. And the news that I didn't know until I heard this is that the nucleus accumbens, part of this reward pathway, actually gets smaller in advanced meditators. That is, they have practiced letting go of being compelled to do stuff, to get stuff.
such that I would think that they have a healthy level of desire. But that brings us to what Abraham was asking about, which is there such a thing as having no desire at all? And you hear about that in some of these legends of people like Ramana Maharshi, who I guess they had to cart out of the snow and start to feed because he didn't care what happened to him, you know? So I think that the extreme of no self, although it's something that we aspire to, you know, the Buddhists say no self, no problem, right? But also, no self, no life. So there's an appropriate level of selfness, selfing. What happens is not what Maslow said about self-actualizing people. It's not that they lose their sense of self. They actually become more uniquely themselves than people that are kind of homogenized like the rest of us. They become uniquely this person or that person or the other person. They don't lose their sense of self. But what happens is the sense of self, as it becomes very defined in a unique way, opens out. So the sense of self becomes more and more inclusive. It's not that you lose a sense of self. You gain a larger sense of self. So you're not so me against you, or different than you. You're me and you. We're all ultimately a unity. So you don't lose your sense of self. You gain a different sense of self, a non-isolated, more connected sense of self, because you're more open to the world and more connected to it. There's less boundary. There's less barrier. Let's keep going, okay?
Now, it's very refreshing.
How do you get to be a regular meditator? And the answer is, I think, start very, very small. I know for myself, I have a subchapter in my book called Confessions of a Yoga Meditator, because I think I have tried all different kinds of meditation. And my big mistake early on was to try and meditate for too long at a sitting. So I would try and meditate for 20, 25 minutes with no meditation experience. And it was a disaster. I forced myself to do it for 30 days thinking that that would be it and I would form my habit. And day 31, I took a long break and I never came back. But then when I came back again, starting very, very small with things that you know I could just do on my own, just breathing meditation, focusing on the breath, something that we all do at the end of yoga classes. That's what really kind of helped me build my muscle. And I just have to stick with that very short meditation and build it up that way. And I think people too often either start too long or don't stick with it enough. But again, shorter is better.
My powers of prognostication are not great. I bought a lot of stock in the company.
Okay, so let's okay. That point is really well taken. I think most of us know this. But I think the deal, the way that I have been able to meditate pretty much every day for many, many years, is I make a deal with myself. I say, the deal is you got to do it, but there's no time that you have to do it for. So I say, oh, damn it, all right, I'll do it for 2 minutes. 2 minutes. And then I sit for 2 minutes, and I go, oh, come on, I need 2 minutes. And it goes as long as it goes. You know. But if I had to do 20 minutes or whatever it is, I would do it. Because I don't have the time and I don't want to. But 2 minutes, whatever, just sit down. Just you know. So I think that's the way you kind of seduce yourself into meditating on a regular basis. Is you just say, you know, this is something like brushing my teeth. It's really a mental hygiene. I got to do it. But I don't have to do it. Make it a labor. And when you're teaching other, when you're telling other people, you want to counsel them not to sit for long. Say, you really don't want to put that burden on yourself. You will go away from this if you do that. You really want to sit for 5 minutes maximum. That's what I tell people, 5 minutes maximum. But in that 5 minutes, do it. Don't spend 4.5 minutes lost in thought or say half asleep. For 2 minutes or 3 minutes, you can actually pay close attention. And people can do that. They're not trained yet. These are new shoes and they're not trained.
they don't know how to do it themselves. Or to stay knotted.
Or lazy.
Okay. And actually, there are different varieties of shoelaces. Depends on how much money you spend for a shoe. These are middle range shoes, so the shoelaces don't grab as well as the ones that, you know, for the high end shoes. All right, this is the last comment, and then we'll move into what else we're doing. But I wanted you to hear Dan Harris talk about this, and I wanted to make a comment about it.
Stick with it enough, but again, shorter is better.
My powers of prognostication are not great. I bought a lot of stock in a company that made Palm Pilot back in 2000. That didn't go so well for me. But having said that, I'm going to make a prediction. I think we're looking at meditation as the next big public health revolution. In the 1940s, if you told people that you went running, they would say, who's chasing you? Right now, if you tell people you meditate, and I have a lot of experience in telling people this, they're going to look at you like you're a little weird most of the time. That's going to change. Meditation is going to join the pantheon of no-brainers like exercise, brushing your teeth, and taking the meds that your doctor prescribes to you. These are all things that if you don't do, you feel guilty about. And that is where I think we're heading with meditation, because the science is so strongly suggestive that meditation can do really, really great things for your brain and for your body.
So I just want to say something about that, which is it really is amazing what's happened. How mindfulness has become such a buzzword in the culture and such a part of the culture, and so many people are at least attempting. It's not that the reason that that has happened is because we're so stressed out that when anybody says, this is something that will make you less stressed for a couple of minutes, people really like that, and it has obvious effect. So how ubiquitous is this becoming? I teach this to all my students at City College. I used to have to sneak it in. Now it's part of the curriculum. It's actually in the books, you know, so I don't have to kind of sneak it in. When I ask students, you know, how many people meditate, or how many people have tried mindfulness, a majority raise their hand at this point. Now, what I explain is that we can look at mindfulness as having three levels. One level is the level of just sitting down and relaxing for a while. That's the level that most people interact with mindfulness. You mean I get to do nothing for 5 minutes? Thank God. And then the second level of mindfulness is, instead of paying attention to past and future, be in the default mode network of your brain, pay attention to right now. Some people get that. You know, it's not only am I sitting down and letting go for a couple of minutes, but I'm also like going, what's happening right now? So some subset of the people that are just sitting and spacing, are sitting and bitching, sitting and chilling, are sitting and actually trying to come to the present moment. But the third level of mindfulness, the level at which you witness internal and external reality very clearly without getting caught up in any of that, that level is completely esoteric at this point. Almost no one that has, quote, learned mindfulness out there knows to do that. Because that's much more, it's a much subtler, more profound, and difficult to learn process.
What do you call it?
Witnessing. It's being mindful, really. The others are steps that you take toward being mindful. But that is not part of the culture yet, and won't be. It will be part of a subculture, but it's too profound for, I think, most people to come to that, be able to step back from one's life experience and notice it clearly without being identified with it. I think that's something that might not become part and parcel of the culture, at least not for a while. Questions or comments on anything so far? Robin?
I just, a little clarification, is that like the observer stuff?
Yes.
Watch the clouds or
yeah.
The trauma, you just go by?
Yeah. Okay. It's being the sky, not the clouds.
Got it.
Yeah. It's the observer. Called witnessing, different people call it different. Bare awareness, pure awareness. So.
Sorry.
I'm not going to be able to get as far as I thought I would get, well, that's always the case, this morning with this, but we'll at least start this and then next week we'll continue it. Is this a good level that people could hear at? I'm going to use this for a little bit and then I'm going to switch to the other one, so we'll have to do another auditory audio test. But anyway, what I'm going to do now is talk about, to illustrate the idea that consciousness is primary and physical reality is secondary, or emerges from consciousness, I'm going to use the work of Stan Grof. That's work that a lot of you know something about. So I want to talk to you just a little bit about Stan Grof and what his contribution has been, to remind you, or in case you don't know. First of all, My interaction with Stan Grof is the first job that I had out of graduate school was being a psychedelic psychotherapist at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center in Catonsville, Maryland, outside Baltimore, the last place in the country where it was legal to do research on psychedelics. And my coworker was Stan Grof. So I spent a year co-working with him, but really being his student. I mean, I went there to be a student, and we worked together a great deal. And then I left, and he left shortly thereafter, and went to Esalen Institute in Big Sur. And for the next 4 years, I would see him on occasion to continue learning from him. His contribution. So what happened to him is he was a very straight psychiatrist, young psychiatrist, who in Yugoslavia volunteered for some sort of experiment. They gave him Sandoz Corporation in Switzerland had been making LSD since Albert Hofmann synthesized it, and Sandoz was interested in what this might be efficacious for, and so they gave anybody that was qualified as much as they wanted to do research on. So Stan volunteered to be part of this study to see what this stuff did, and they brought him into the laboratory, and they gave him 500 mics of Sandoz LSD, and he had it to triple the lifetime, which completely changed him. So he became interested in what this substance was. This was in, the late 1950s when he had this first experience. He became interested in how something could be like, you know, could change consciousness like this, and what its efficacy could be therapeutically. So in the next 10 years or so, he did a remarkable amount of clinical work with people with all kinds of psychiatric syndromes, and also normal people, and also exceptional people, to see what their trips would be like, and to see what benefit could be gotten from using these substances. He tried all the psychedelics. At that point, they were all legal. So what he came up with, starting in the late 1960s, was a synthesis. At first, these were just tremendously unusual experiences that nobody understood, a lot of them. But he began to realize that they had some sort of, you could understand them in terms of certain kinds of psychology, and that they had a certain ordering. That is, as people had psychedelic sessions, they had a tendency to move through these levels of consciousness. So he made a map of consciousness. And the map of consciousness had three sections to it. A Freudian section, where what Freud was saying was essentially right, although not completely right. A Rankian section, R-A-N-K, based on the work of Otto Rank, who talked about the birth trauma, the perinatal period, the period around the birth. And then the work of Carl Jung, who talked about the collective unconscious and archetypes and things that were kind of quasi-spiritual. So Freud about the personal unconscious, what happened to you early in your life, Rank about your birth, gestation and birth, and Jung about the things that were either prior to your birth or after your death, or levels of consciousness right now that you don't generally access. They put this all together in an extended cartography of human consciousness, which I'm not going to talk more about now, but at some point I probably will. The third thing that he did is after he started to especially look at the Jungian areas, the areas that became something called transpersonal psychology, that were essentially, all right, a very quick personal anecdote. I was there as a very young person when transpersonal psychology was first getting cooked up by Stan Grof and Anthony Soonish and Abe Maslow and others, and Jim Fadiman, and they had come up with the term transpersonal psychology. And being young and loudmouthed, I said, "That's terrible. That's a terrible term. It doesn't mean anything to the average person. That term will never fly. Why don't you call it spiritual psychology?" And they said, "Oh, spiritual, man, where are you kidding? The word spiritual, that would make us unscientific." And I said, no, it is spiritual psychology. And they won, and they lost. You never hear about transpersonal psychology anymore. So they should have listened to me. sometimes out of the mouths of babes come gems. So anyway, what Grof began to realize as he saw these kind of more profound experiences, Jungian experiences, he realized that these experiences had been talked about before, a lot before. In fact, these were the experiences that all the spiritual systems around the world had talked about. These were what Aldous Huxley called the perennial philosophy, the idea that there's a basic spiritual understanding that is the foundation for all the world's religions. You know, not that the world's religions remember that, but that this was the genesis of the spiritual genesis of all these practices. So what Stan did is he unified modern consciousness research, especially using psychedelics and then holotropic breathwork, with spirituality, and showed that there was only, they were talking about the same mind, the same psyche. Is this good?
Yeah.
Really? Okay. Fantastic. I'll try it. So if you're interested in what I talked about when I talked about the three levels of consciousness that Grof talked about, Freudian, Rankian, and Jungian, the book that I would most recommend is The Holotropic Mind. Stan has written a lot of books. Some are pretty thick and difficult to understand. This book was written with a co-writer. It's called The Holotropic Mind, and it's the book that I tell people to start on Grof with. So it's a really interesting book. But the book I'm going to read from, The Cosmic Game, is a total mind blower, as you'll see. This book never got adequate recognition. Maybe someday it will. But I'm going to read a little bit from The Cosmic Game, okay? About the idea that...
I've read from it before.
I have read from it before, yes. Yeah. And so I'm going to use some of the same excerpts and some different excerpts. But I'm not going to read it at such great lengths from it. Okay. So, where are we? Okay, sorry. I will, therefore, narrow our discussion to a large and important subgroup of non-ordinary states of consciousness for which contemporary psychiatry does not have a specific term. Because I'm convinced that they deserve to be distinguished from the rest and placed in a special category, I have coined for them the term holotropic, holotropic. This composite word literally means oriented toward wholeness, or moving in the direction of wholeness. From the Greek word holos, means whole, and trepion, moving toward or in the direction of something. The full meaning of this term, the justification for its use, will become clear later in this book. It suggests that our everyday state of consciousness, it suggests that in our everyday state of consciousness, we are not really whole, W-H-O-L-E. We are fragmented and identified with only a small fraction of who we really are. Holotropic experiences can be induced by a variety of ancient and aboriginal techniques, so-called technologies of the sacred. These procedures combine in various ways drumming, rattling, sounds of bells or gongs, chanting, rhythmic dancing, changes of breathing, and cultivation of special forms of awareness. They might include extended social and sensory isolation, fasting, sleep deprivation, dehydration, and even drastic physical interventions, such as bloodletting, powerful laxatives and purgatives, and infliction of severe pain. A particularly effective technology of the sacred has been the ritual use of psychedelic plants and substances. These mind-altering techniques have played a critical role in the ritual and spiritual history of humanity. Induction of holotropic states has been absolutely essential for shamanism, rites of passage, and other ceremonies of native cultures. It also represented the key element of the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth that were conducted in different parts of the world and particularly flourished in the Mediterranean area. Holotropic experiences have been equally important for various mystical branches of the great religions of the world. These esoteric traditions have developed a variety of technologies of the sacred, specific methods of inducing experiences. Here belong various forms of yoga, meditation and concentration techniques, multivocal chanting, whirling of the dervishes, ascetic practices, the Christian hesychasm or Jesus prayer, and many others. In modern times, the spectrum of mind-altering techniques has been considerably enriched. The clinical approaches include the use of pure alkaloids from psychedelic plants or synthetic psychedelic substances, as well as powerful forms of experiential psychotherapy, such as hypnosis, primal therapy, rebirthing, and holotropic breathwork. The most popular of the laboratory methods for inducing holotropic states has been sensory deprivation, an approach based on various degrees of reduction of sensory stimuli. Another well-known method is biofeedback, which makes it possible to use information about the changes in one's brain as a guideline to specific states of consciousness. Many special electronic devices use the principle of entrainment or driving the brain waves by various acoustic and optical stimuli. In writing this book, I used the records I had amassed during more than 40 years of work in the field of consciousness studies. I have focused specifically on those parts of the records that described experiences and observations related to basic ontological and cosmological questions. Ontology is the basic structure of the universe. Cosmology is the large-scale structure of the universe. To my surprise, he was a real straight guy beforehand. He wasn't raised religiously at all. He and his brother were psychiatrists and were science people. To my surprise, what emerged from these accounts of holotropic states was a comprehensive and logically consistent alternative to the understanding of human nature and of existence that has been formulated by materialistic science and that represents the official ideology of the Western industrial civilization. People who experience holotropic states and integrate them effectively do not develop idiosyncratic, delusional worldviews representing disjointed distortions of objective reality. I'll read that again. People who experience holotropic states and integrate them effectively do not develop idiosyncratic, delusional worldviews representing disoriented distortions of objective reality. They discover various partial aspects of a grand vision of a universe that is created and permeated by superior cosmic intelligence. They discover partial aspects of a grand vision of a universe that is created and permeated by superior cosmic intelligence. In the last analysis, this ensouled cosmos is commensurate with their own psyche and consciousness. These insights show a remarkable similarity to the understanding of reality that has repeatedly emerged, often quite independently, throughout history in different parts of the world. In many variations, this vision of reality has been shared by all the people who have had the opportunity to complement their everyday experience of material reality with insights from holotropic states of consciousness. So he's saying this is all over the place throughout history. What people are discovering through these modern technologies is the same as people have discovered forever. This finding brings good news to the millions of Westerners and people in technical... Did I want to go here? Yeah, I did. This finding brings good news to the millions of Westerners and people in technological societies who have had various forms of holotropic experiences and were unable to integrate them within the belief system of their mainstream cultures. Because of this discrepancy, many of them question their own sanity or have their sanity questioned by others, including the mental health professionals from whom they sought advice or to whom they were brought against their will. Many of these states of consciousness used to be considered by psychiatry to be psychotic. The study of holotropic states vindicates these people and reveals the shortcomings of contemporary psychiatry. It shows an urgent need for a radical revisioning and revisioning of our understanding of human nature and of the nature of reality.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how can you tell the difference between psychosis and something good?
Okay, so how do you tell the difference between a psychotic state and a revelatory state or an inspirational state? By the effect. Psychotic states make people non-functional and worse. Okay, with proper support, people who have had experiences beyond the usual sense of self, they feel better. They report an enhancement, and they're not non-functional. They become more functional.
Maybe it's just a matter of interpretation.
It's a matter of what?
Maybe it's just a matter of interpretation.
No, you can take objective people and you can say, this person, is that person functional? Is that person doing something stuff in the world that, can that person take care of themselves? Is that person helping other people? And psychotic people, they have to be taken care of. They're not functional.
But maybe So, well, I have a friend who started having psychotic episodes, and she became terrified and sought treatment. But maybe if she interpreted it a different way.
Okay, so the question is, would some of the people that are labeled psychotic, if they were supported, would they have a different interpretation of their experience, and would they have a different outcome? And as those of you who know that Sam and his wife, Christina, started something called the Spiritual Emergency Network, which became the Spiritual Emergence Network, and for quite a number of years, helped people who had some of these experiences to be supported and to interpret them differently. And they changed a lot of people's experience from having to go to a psychiatric hospital to being at Esalen and well supported, for example, and coming out better for their experience. Not everybody. Having experiences that shatter your usual sense of self doesn't necessarily mean those experiences are going to be from kind of a higher level. Some of those experiences are a real failure of selfness. And those kind of folks, they become psychotic, and with medication, they can be somewhat functional, but they're schizophrenic. Other people have these experiences and become more profound. They become spiritual teachers, they become just more creative people. What's the name of the guy? Oh, R.D. Lang. Yeah, so I'm going to tell you a little story about R.D. Lang. I can't read too much of this. R.D. Lang used to have blowout centers for people that had experiences that caused them to not be in the same reality that we're in. He supported them in that process, and many of them came through those blowout centers, very enriched people. So he was famous for doing that. So he came to Santa Barbara once, many years ago, to the La Cumbre Junior High School auditorium. And every mental health person in Santa Barbara, 1,600 I think, people crowded into that auditorium to hear the great R.D. Lang. I was in the front row. I was in the front row of everything when I could. I was absolutely in the front row listening to this guy. And what happened over the course of the evening is people would start to leave and start to leave and start to leave and start to leave. Why? Because he was drunk. The same way Chogyam Trungpa was. I'll tell that story next. But anyway, so R.D. Lang, he was kind of drunk, and he kind of got up there, and for a long time he didn't say anything, and then he would say something, and he would stop for a long period of time, and people would just like. But what he said, when he said stuff, was just so wonderful. And the thing that stuck with me all these years is he said, "I have no special talent for helping these people. The only difference between me and other people is I'm not afraid of them." I'm not afraid of them. I just go and hang out with them. But I always talk about that, because I think that many of us clinicians, there's a certain level of fear in going into that kind of disturbed environment of another person. And he just said, "I'm just not afraid." Now, the Chogyam Trungpa story. Should I tell this? Yeah, no. Okay. Trungpa was amazing and controversial, and I don't want to defend everything that he did, apparently, but, and he was an alcoholic. This was 1976 at Esalen Institute during a 40-day conference called Buddhism and Mind that changed Esalen into a spiritual community, where Stan Grof and Jack Kornfield, Stan Grof invited all the Buddhists in the West that were of any prominence to come, and they all came, and they talked to one another and instructed the people at Esalen and seminarians like myself. So it was an amazing, amazing, amazing event. And Trungpa was one of the people that came. And so we were all crowded into the basement of the big house. Those of you who know that there's a big house at Esalen, not by the dining hall, but separate than that. We were all like 150 people crowded in there. And Trungpa was supposed to show up at 7 o'clock, and it's like 7:30. And there's no Trungpa,
And people are starting to go, and it's 8 o'clock and there's no trouble. And finally, like about 8:30, like an hour and a half later, he comes. And, oh no, he came like, maybe it was an hour, maybe 2 hours later. Meanwhile, he came and he was drunk, and he gave the lecture. But I thought that it was the most brilliant lecture that he could ever have given. And he gave it before he gave it. Because what happened was, each person that was sitting there waiting had some kind of reaction to the waiting. And it was really clear to me, I was meditating the whole time. I was meditating the whole 40 days. At that point, I kind of was meditating on it. And I was just watching this. And I was watching everybody's personality come out. And it couldn't have been better. He couldn't have given any kind of lecture that was better than having these people demonstrate. And I think the same thing happened during RD Lab. People, who they were, came out by that unusual circumstance. That's a little bit about Trungpa. Okay.
I'm sorry, who is this person, Trungpa?
Chögyam Trungpa. T-R-U-N-G-P-A. Just Google Trungpa. He started Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, which is still happening. He had I think it was called the Tail of the Tiger Center in Vermont, I think it was. So he was a very influential early Buddhist. All right. Where I'm gonna go next week is after this preliminary stuff to kind of establish what Graf is doing. I'm gonna talk to you about he puts together very succinctly what the people that were having these holotropic experiences experienced, and what spiritual traditions have said about the basic nature, the most profound experience of ultimate reality. That's what I'm going to be describing. Okay, and that'll be next week, the entire next week's class. Is what exactly, if you've had an experience of finally getting to the most basic substrate of the universe, what does that look like? And it looks, and how is that, how do various world cultures talk about that basic experience? All right, so it's about time to break. I can't like do 2 minutes more. So do you have any, in the last 2 minutes, do you have any question or comment? Let's see if there's anything from you guys in the last 2 minutes. Colette, loud, or I'll yell.
Will Stanislav Grof come to this group again?
Say again?
Will Stanislav Grof come as a guest speaker again?
There's a psychedelic, some of you know, there's an enormous psychedelic conference happening in June in Denver, Colorado. It's going to bring together 5,000 to 10,000 researchers on psychedelics. You would expect Stan to be there if he was okay, but he's not going to be there. So I think that he's basically, at this point, he's in his late 80s. And I think that he's not well enough to come. If I find anything different about that, I'll let you know. He lives in Mill Valley. But he's not been as active as before. Other questions or comments? Amira.
Yeah, the word holotropic, I'm wondering, it's a composite word, but what do each of those roots mean, holotropic?
Okay, I'll do it again. Holotropic means oriented toward wholeness, or moving in the direction of wholeness. From the Greek word holos, H-O-L-O-S, which means whole, and tropion, which means moving toward or in the direction of. So what Graf is saying is all these states of consciousness that spiritual traditions talk about and that consciousness explorers talk about, they're all about becoming a less partial version of ourselves, about becoming more whole. we apparently, why are we partial rather than whole? Because evolution has given us what we need to survive. So we don't see the world as it is. We see a window on the world that serves our survival. You know this. The electromagnetic spectrum is this enormous spectrum of energies of which we see visible light, a little tiny bit in the middle. We don't see all the other stuff that's zipping around, you know, radio waves and television and cell phone and gamma rays and all this kind of stuff that's zipping around right here. We don't have any way to see that. Apparently, our consciousness has developed to only deal with the things that keep us physically alive. And so we miss the larger structure of the universe. That's the problem that we're in. And there's a guy named Arthur Dyckman who wrote a book called De-Automization, and an article, and maybe a book, but an article called De-Automization and the Mystic Experiences. And he said that people who have mystic experiences, they come out of this restricted way of looking at things, and they see things more as they see things more as the whole thing is, they really are. So we can look at our life journey as a journey of personal growth. And that personal growth is an enlargement of our view of ourselves and the world. And Maslow said that people who are self-actualized, they just have they have more wisdom because they see more of the world. And they identify less with themselves and more with their connections. So it goes like this. Psychosis and psychosis is fracturing of the sense of self. Neurosis is an unstable sense of self. Mental health is a reasonably focused sense of self. And then personal growth and personal growth and self-actualization and spiritual realizations are a broadening of the sense of self. So the person that has an ego strength, as Freud wanted us to have, a person that has a strong sense of self, they're not in trouble, but they're not self-realized yet. That has to grow into a sense of self that is strong and yet open and inclusive. And you know, so there's some people that are very narcissistic, but very successful and enviable in the way that they are really strong and confident. But they're not people that are helping the world terribly much. They're generally getting rich, you know. The process is a process of identifying and incorporating more and more who you really are. That's what's being said by everybody. Until ultimately you realize that you're everything. That you're one point in a hologram. You know, it's the whole thing is in you. You're equivalent to everything. Mike.
You were just referring to your consciousness being defined by your experience, really, your limited experience. And I often think of this in terms of animals. They may well be conscious, but their sense of being conscious is different from our sense of being conscious. So this gets to the point that consciousness comes from the physical environment that organism might be.
No.
So maybe we'll have a class coming from that direction also.
We did have a class. I mean, we have had a class coming from that direction. But no, what's being said is that consciousness is, from this point of view, which you don't have to buy, but we have to entertain anyway, consciousness is the whole thing. And our consciousness is a reducing valve from that consciousness that only takes in the part of consciousness that helps us in our physical environment. In other words, each of us just partakes of one channel of the multi-channel consciousness that is real. We partake of the human channel.
I was going to say, will you include animal consciousness in that whole sphere of consciousness?
Well, people who have this point of view the point of view that consciousness is primary, they say that consciousness, everything is consciousness. It just physicalizes by the way you look at it.
So this is a different aspect from the way you set out to begin with. This is saying that there isn't physical reality, there's just consciousness.
That's this point of view says that the ontological reality is consciousness, and physical reality is a secondary formation, a secondary concatenation, a secondary glomming together of consciousness. That is, and okay, so the last thing I'll say today is that this isn't so far out, people. Every time you meditate, you realize this. That is, every time you meditate, you realize that what you're paying attention to, if it's a sound or an itch or anything else, is your own mind, right? That's the only thing that you're really directly aware of. So if there is a world out there, it's being brought to you by your own mind. Never mind when you meditate, as you walk around, you're not walking around in the world. You don't see me. You see a reconstruction in your brain of me. It is a virtual reality in your brain. That's the only thing you know for sure. Is there a world out there? Are there other people out there? Maybe. There's no way to prove that. Science can't prove that. It just makes your sensory apparatus better. But it doesn't... It's just feeding you more information for your virtual reality. So... people who have these profound states of consciousness, they say there is a convincing level to this. There's a level when you have an experience of consciousness as a one universal intelligence, as being the thing that issues forth everything else. They say that when you have that kind of experience, you don't have doubt anymore. But that experience is you've come to the end of the search. And that you realize that that's the basic nature of things. But if you haven't had that experience, then the question is there a world out there that I'm seeing in my brain right now? And from science's point of view, yeah, there's a world out there, and your nervous system is doing a pretty good job of giving you an internal representation of part of it. But what you see inside is a window on something larger. You only get a little bit of it in your virtual reality. You don't get the whole thing. And so these technologies of the sacred have to do with giving you a larger view of what's out there. And some of you have had dreams that seem to be real and seem to be different than this reality. That might be another kind of leaking, another window opening up. Abraham and then Colette.
Yeah, for a long time I've been asking the question, how did consciousness come about? And I couldn't find any answer.
Okay, so there's two levels to the question of how consciousness comes about. Level one is that consciousness doesn't come about. Consciousness is the primary factor that is always and ever, ideas in our mind. The thing that's there, and it isn't a thing, and it isn't there, is consciousness. And then there's a level of how our individual consciousness comes about, and if you can solve that, you not only win a Nobel Prize, you get to be one of the greatest scientists that ever lived. Maybe the greatest, because that's one of the three fundamental questions, which is how your physical lump of matter called the brain gives rise, supposedly, it either gives rise to your consciousness or it transduces, it receives your consciousness. Oh God, all right, the last thing. If we were scientists and we had never seen a television, we would go over, okay, so this is the one you want to remember. If we were scientists and we had never seen a television, we would go over to the television, we would turn the television on, there would be a show, we would turn the channel, there would be different channels, we would kick the thing and it would go, and we would go, oh, I see, it's pretty clear from the data I've gathered that the show is produced by the television. The television makes the show. Your mind makes the show that you're seeing. But that's wrong. If we were better scientists, and look, knew where to look. We would realize that television doesn't produce the show. Television transduces the show. It receives the energy from the broadcasting station, and it makes it onto the television. So from this point of view, our individual mind is receiving something larger and making it into our particular virtual reality called me and my world. What?
And my personal television.
Yeah, it's my personal television, but it's coming, it's receiving something. So the question is whether we don't know the answer to either of these. We don't know how it is that we either receive or create out of our brain the consciousness that we have. Okay. But the kind of consciousness that is the fundamental kind of consciousness has a different flavor. It's experientially different than the kind of consciousness you have now. And that's where we're going next week. See you next week.